the email from this week announced that tonight's topic was going to be holding it all close and lightly. It's common to think that that's a dichotomy, that holding something close to our hearts includes not wanting to let it go. When we think of these two principles, loving and letting go, our minds kind of automatically flash to the people we love and how we never want to be without them. Our children, our life partners, our best friends and relatives. Being prepared for their departure from our lives seems anathema to really loving them. But what parent dreams of their toddler being 35 years old and living in the spare room? If that child has special needs, the parents are probably preparing themselves for that eventuality. But the dream is usually for the child to have an independent life when they grow up. This powerful, deep love of parents has built into it the hope of being able to let go. And anyone who's ever rescued a bird knows the joy of holding it with open hands and feeling it take flight. The readiness to let go of what we love is the beating heart of caring, of engagement with this always changing planet and the amazing life that it has. It takes a poise, a balance between holding close and holding lightly. It's the kind of courage that other people admire in someone, but which we ourselves, if it's us, don't experience as bravery. From the inside, it's just love. It's loving the very cruelty of the earth with its continually turning, predatory, and beautifully caring nature. You might have guessed that my intellectual hobbies include nature documentaries, but also medieval history. Both of these are fascinating and bloody. I think of Carlos Castaneda's character, Don Juan, and how he said we should live with death on one of our shoulders. When I read that at the age of 18, I was horrified because I'd been enculturated in a society that dressed death up in an ornate box and then buried it deep in the ground with just a stone monument that we could go to be with our loved ones. If you take a survey of different cultures' way of channeling the tendency to cling that's a component of grief, you'll see that very few societies really prepare people for life after the loss. We know we have to let go, but there's a real desire not to anticipate it, not to be ready to do that. About a month ago, I gave a talk on living through loss and pointed out that grief is the process of letting go, one that we just have to go through. It's not fun, but it's part of what it takes to love. If we take Don Juan's advice truly to heart, this process can go a little easier. Preparing for loss starts right now. It starts with opening the heart, completely open. It starts when you sit down to meditate with an open and accepting awareness that lets in anything, lets it come in and lets it go out of the awareness, including thoughts, feelings, and physical sensations that all just arise and pass away. This is the constant kaleidoscope of experience. As it happens while we meditate, it's like the microcosm. As we go through the years of our life, that's the macrocosm. It's all the same. We experience, as we sit and meditate, the ambulance wailing down the street, or the smell of car exhaust arising, passing away, and a pleasant memory come into our thoughts. And as we return to mindfulness, we let it pass away. Over and over, pleasant and unpleasant, arising, abiding for a while, passing away. And so we practice with all of the gains and losses that can happen in life, whether we like them or not. And this willingness to accept is the point of the pin that holds the Dharma together. It's the heart of the lion in the glittering chest of a hummingbird. And I hate to tell you this, but I can't resist. Hummingbirds are carnivorous. That's life. That knowledge comes into the awareness, and it may pass away. But being open to all that is gives us the courage to show up and be present with all of life, and to taste the nectar of every shape and color in the landscape of our lives. With this, we can actually conquer death. Because we're rendered fearless and able to love without limit. At a Jewish memorial service for my partner, the rabbi said, "It is holy to love what can die." And we all do it. So let's acknowledge and celebrate our bravery. and love more, infinitely, loving even the loss that inevitably comes with all forms of love. You know, if I had titled this talk Equanimity, it could have been a bloodless exposition of the near and far enemies that demonstrate what equanimity is not. I've given such talks, and you can listen to them on the Sangha website, and I recommend them. But tonight I wanted to talk about the living reality of equanimity as a vibrant and heroic presence that gives us a steadiness and serenity. It lets us hold all of our experience, everything close to our hearts, while we hold it lightly, like a butterfly in the open hand. So now that I've dealt with the grandeur of some of life's most momentous events, let's talk about equanimity and the presidential election. I mean, really? This might seem like jumping from the sublime to the ridiculous, but I'm talking about the same tool in our kit, the big tool, mindfulness. Open, accepting awareness. And we practice it not just in meditation, but in all of our experience. And this election is not trivial. Regardless of its outcome, some major repairs to civilization are going to be needed. It requires and will continue to require the best of our practice, holding it close and lightly. Psychotherapists have even coined a new diagnosis. They're calling it election stress disorder. This campaign is literally making people crazy. Very few people are unscathed by the vitriol and sleaziness that bombards us daily through the media and our conversations. It's like ambulance sirens and car exhausts all day long. And how are we coping? Well, not very well. Not most of us. I've been talking about the toxicity of this campaign process pretty much from its beginning. But I wanted to refrain from being political and hold out the hope that sanity would prevail. I still don't think that I personally need to point out the source of the nastiness. Most observers nowadays are pretty clear about that. But what I do need to point out are the wounds that we've sustained as a result of being subjected to the verbal assaults month after month. It's been over a year that this has just been coming at us steadily. And as a nation, we've taken a major hit. And we need to look at how we've been injured and how we can heal. The Washington Post just had an article about election stress disorder. And it quoted several mindfulness practitioners, including a congressman, and also some psychologists. And they all recommended ways of coping with this onslaught of foul-mouthed, really hateful speech. And what they painted was the picture of mindfulness. What we need to deal with this threat to democracy in our own lives and also in our public life is equanimity, to get the political process moving back to a civilized path. In this article in Washington Post, the first part was the psychologist describing the damage that this kind of public discourse does and how it tempts us to sink to the same level and resort to blame and hatred ourselves when we hear people talking in those terms. And we tense up both physically and psychically and become irritable and impatient in our relationships. It narrows our perspective to see only what we want to believe. And this is happening on both sides. It's called confirmation bias. It keeps digging us deeper and deeper into a vision of us versus them. And tragically, it does this to us in all aspects of our lives. We see those with whom we disagree about anything as having character flaws and not just different opinions. In other words, what I'm saying is, what this psychologist is saying, is that it carries over from our awareness of politics into our one-on-one relationships. And I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen with friends, and I've seen it happen in my own kitchen. I think what we need to do is just take a really deep breath. Maybe over and over, and keep coming back to relaxed mindfulness. If you don't know this name, I'm happy to introduce you to Reverend Angel Kyodo Williams, who founded a Zendo for people of color in Berkeley, about almost 15 years ago. She emphasizes in some of her writings that mindfulness isn't just to reduce the stress that we're feeling from this political environment right now, but we need it to truly practice the Dharma. We can't just turn away. We can't just block it out. I mean, we can't, but that doesn't serve us or anyone else. If instead we face the fears and the revulsion that this election has brought up in us, and face it with all of the divine abodes, with metta, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, then we can bring a healing to our reactions, to the way we have reacted, to the way the society has reacted to this bombardment of meanness. And we need to be sane. We need to have the steadiness of mindfulness, because the democratic process is us. And we need to be sane for its sake. Unfortunately, at this point, so many people are so hooked into the mindset of recent politics that it's really hard to regain equilibrium. What we all need is boundaries. And remembering that mindfulness involves being fully present and balanced, equanimous, and not just tuning it all out. Thich Nhat Hanh interprets the fifth precept about intoxicants to include limiting the harmful mental input that we consume, like books, television, conversations, social media. We need to stay attuned to our bodies so we can tell when it's getting to us, when we've had enough. We can be aware of what a certain candidate has said and how it affects us without having to watch and listen to him say it repeatedly all day long. So, boundaries. It's what you need to have with little kids. And we need it to get out of what therapists call the toddler brain, which is a habit we get into of oversimplifying, clinging, and intolerance. We need to find ways to move back into our adult brain and recognize that whenever we devalue others, we don't feel good about ourselves either. This means that we really can let ourselves see things from the perspective of our political opponents and see their suffering, their fears and hopes. We can stay mindful of our emotional response and still listen to the disturbing noise that's going on now. With mindfulness, we can wisely limit what we take in. So this is different than just walking away from it, hiding our heads in the sand. I'm talking about setting mature boundaries. Like, once we've heard the gist of the story, turning off the news feed, wherever it comes from, whether it's TV, radio, conversation, it's okay to say that's enough. And just simply bowing out of incendiary discussions. We can find something positive to do politically, like walking precincts, staffing phone banks, donating, and the very simple, invaluable act of voting, which is the very lifeblood of democracy. And as we go through our normal day, if we've got one left, we can take every opportunity we get to practice kindness and generosity. Action that's intended to help others, like wholesome civic involvement, is a wonderful antidote to what's been going on in the airwaves around us. Kindness can move us across the universe from ill will to love, from fear to courage, and into the realm of trusting that this life, with its full panoply of things we like and dislike, is absolutely worth living to the best of our ability, no matter what happens. Moving from me to we to a deeply caring connection to all others allows us to hold it all close and lightly. Like gain, loss is inevitable. So is pain. The open heart lets it all in and can treasure it all. It can care and act to celebrate the joys and soothe the suffering of all beings, and stay poised to let it all go. May you find this loving, joyful peace in every moment. Thank you.